Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. He's an American icon around whom has evolved an entire culture, the culture of rock and roll. He is Elvis Presley. In a moment, we'll be talking about Elvis with the author of a new book on the star, Erica Doss. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event from this week in history. Contrary to popular opinion, Eleanor Roosevelt was not the first woman to advance the cause of women in American politics. Nellie Ross Taylor preceded her by a decade when during this week in 1924 she became governor of the state of Wyoming, succeeding her deceased husband, William Ross. After being nominated for the position, Nellie Ross refused to actively campaign, insisting instead on staying at home to care for her children, traumatized at the recent and unexpected death of their father. Ross nevertheless won election, the importance of which she explained at a women's club dinner in 1925. Now that a woman has for the first time been admitted to a seat at the council table, it is not only vital but highly consistent that her voice be the voice of humanity. Though she would serve only one term as Wyoming governor, President Franklin Roosevelt later appointed Nellie Ross Taylor director of 8 United States Mints. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, paleontologists in southern France have discovered new evidence that links 100,000-year-old Neanderthals to a more prehistoric version of Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter. After uncovering human remains in a cave that date back to the ancestors of Homo sapiens, researchers are now even more confident that Neanderthal men and women once engaged in cannibalism. While some critics are dismissing chewed, gnawed bones that have even been sucked dry of their bone marrow as a result of animal attacks, proponents point to animal bones found with the human remains cut in exactly the same manner with the same tools. Archivist Guy Rocha of Nevada recently shed new light on the pre-famous life of author Mark Twain, discovering the poet's account of an execution by hanging in Virginia City, Nevada. Upon returning from a tour of Europe and the Holy Land in 1868, Twain was approached by a number of national newspapers requesting his services as a reporter. Writing for the Chicago Republican in the same year, Twain recorded an account of the execution of John Millian, convicted for the murder of local prostitute Julia Boulet. Eagerly awaiting Millian's death, Twain remembers that he saw it all. I took exact note of every detail, even to Millian's considerately helping to fix the leather strap that bound his legs, and I never wish to see it again. You're listening to Talking History.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right.
Elvis Presley is perhaps the most famous singer in American history. But he's more than that. He's a national icon around whom has developed an entire culture. Here to examine that culture is Talking History's Eileen Dugan, who spoke with the author of a recently published book on Elvis culture.
Over 20 years after his death, we still cannot avoid his image. Elvis Presley is everywhere. He adorns clothing, he gyrates on wall clocks, he charms us on postage stamps, and sings to us from slot machines. There are snorkeling Elvises, flying Elvises, Las Vegas wedding chapel Elvises. No street vendor's display of cheap art is complete without the classic velvet Elvis painting. Elvis may have left the building, but he simply can't seem to go away. Why? What is it about Elvis that has made him the ubiquitous American icon? Joining us today to discuss how and why Elvis has become such an enduring cultural icon is Dr. Erica Doss, Professor of Fine Arts and Director of the American Studies Program at the University of Colorado Boulder. She is the author of the recent monograph, Elvis Culture, Fans, Faith, and Image. Welcome, Dr. Doss.
Thank you.
What inspired you in the first place as an academic to pursue the topic of Elvis culture?
That's a good question. I was attending the obligatory academic conference one afternoon, Saturday afternoon, I recall this, and a friend of mine was giving a paper about a very famous Head of Christ painted by an artist named Warner Salmon in 1940. It's sort of the ubiquitous image of Jesus Christ, the blonde Jesus. And I recalled thinking, I grew up with this image and I sort of know this image, but I haven't seen this image in recent decades, and I wonder what image it is that has replaced this image in American visual culture. And this was the fall of 1992, and for some really strange reason, I simply flashed on an image of Elvis Presley. And it was a very emotive response. It was very visceral, and it was very strange. I didn't grow up as an Elvis fan. I had never really thought about Elvis at all in growing up. And I talked to someone later, and they said, you know, you really ought to go with this. We rarely, as academics, have these intuitive sort of experiences, and so I did. And I started seeing Elvis everywhere and talking to people about Elvis in their lives and what Elvis's image means in American culture.
And he really does seem to be everywhere. And it's very strange because Elvis really isn't the only star ever to die young.
No, of course not.
I mean, we think of John Belushi, John Lennon, James Dean. But and Elvis wasn't even at the top of his game anymore. So as you say in your book, why Elvis?
Right.
Why is he so enduring?
I think that the image, and what I talk about extensively in the book, I think that his image is enduring because it's such a mercurial image. There is no single Elvis, for example. There's the rockabilly Elvis. There's the Las Vegas Elvis. There's the Elvis who joined the Army, was drafted into the Army in 1958. There's the Elvis of the B-movies from the 1960s. So there's a variety of Elvises, and that fits perfectly with the diversity of the American population. There's a little bit of Elvis for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, how is it that people are able to make Elvis into something that they can relate to?
I think that a lot of this has to do with the freedom of his image up to now in American culture. Elvis has been present in our culture since the mid-50s, and he really begins to make it in about 1955. He's on national television in 1956, and there's this freedom of his image. He's also incredibly well marketed, both by his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, and by all sorts of media representatives, and he's on the covers of magazines, he's on the television, he's seen everywhere. So he's very, very well marketed in the 1950s, and surprisingly, that continues into the 60s and during his comeback in the late 60s into the 70s. So there's a definite part of his marketed appeal. But then the fans have also taken it upon themselves to keep Elvis's image present and alive in American culture 20, 25 years after his death.
Yeah, they talk about taking care of Elvis.
Exactly.
And how do they do that?
Yeah, a lot of fans feel that the media, and they just sort of speak of the media in these big sort of paranoid terms, sometimes deservedly so, they talk about the media as being bad to Elvis and putting Elvis down, making fun of him. Elvis is repeatedly the victim, as they say, of jokes on Jay Leno and various other talk shows. And they consider it their responsibility then, as Elvis fans, to take care of Elvis, to take care of his image, to create a better representation, and thereby keep his memory alive in American culture.
And there seems to be a little bit of guilt wrapped into this as well. They seem to feel that they owe this to him because of what they feel that they have done with him. How is that so?
Many fans feel that, and I would say that most fans believe that Elvis is indeed dead, but many fans feel that they played a role in his early death, dying at the age of 42 in 1977, in that they demanded his presence on stage, they mobbed his home. Many fans will say it was our fault we wouldn't let the guy have a normal life. And so in a sense, being part of fan culture in the 1990s is a form of payback, post-death payback, if you will, but taking care of Elvis, keeping his memory alive is very much about a sort of a guilty memory.
And so much of this 90s Elvis culture seems to be in the accumulation of what you call Elvis stuff.
Indeed.
And why is it so materialistic, and what forms does this take?
Oh, that's such a good question. And in fact, that's sort of how I got into this entire project, being surrounded by pins and velvet Elvises and just seeing Elvis in every conceivable material culture form and format. Again, a lot of this has to do with marketing. Elvis, incredibly well marketed from the mid-50s, and you name it, everything from Elvis blue jeans to Elvis shoes, Elvis lunchboxes, Elvis dolls, Elvis hairbands, et cetera. And that has continued to the present with Elvis collector plates. And I think an Elvis, sort of an Elvis Ken doll was marketed a few years ago.
Oh, no.
And fans have told me, well, you can't be a real Elvis fan or a true Elvis fan unless you have lots and lots of Elvis stuff. And so fandom is deeply linked to the collection and the collecting of Elvis stuff. Having more stuff, you're more of a fan.
And is this stuff that they have made, or is this the mass-produced stuff?
It's both. And as an art historian, I found it kind of interesting. Well, I would think that a unique item, a sort of one-of-a-kind Elvis item made by a famous artist or a handcrafted item made with lots of love and care would be considered more valuable within Elvis community. Actually, in Elvis culture, the mass-produced items have more value. And in a sense, that's about belonging, and it's about sharing. It's also about price tag. You know, I have all 185 Elvis plates from this particular collection, or I have all 45 liquor decanters from this particular Elvis collection. It's, again, a sign of status in Elvis culture.
And how does Elvis, Inc., the official Elvis company controlling his image, how do they cash in on this, or should I say, how do they promote this Elvis stuff?
Uh-huh. Elvis Presley Enterprises Incorporated owns the name, the image, the voice, and the likeness of Elvis Presley. He's been copyrighted. His image has been copyrighted since the mid-1950s, and it was renewed, repeatedly renewed in the 1980s. And Elvis, Inc., which is a Fortune 500 company headquartered in Memphis with extensions all over the country, controls Elvis's image because there's a lot of money at stake. Their net is about $100 million a year. I mean, this is not a small company. They, of course, run Graceland, provide the tours at Graceland, et cetera. They control his image in that they license those products that people will submit for possible mass production. And there is a lot of money at stake here.
And does this create any tension with the Elvis fans?
It does. Many Elvis fans, and I think Americans in general, are just not aware of the degree to which image has been copyrighted and image is controlled in our culture. And this is increasing, particularly as we head into the 21st century. And so a lot of fans will, for fan clubs, for example, and there are over 500 Elvis fan clubs, they'll make their own T-shirts or they'll sell Elvis handcraft items because a lot of the fan clubs are involved in philanthropy and charity. And they have come up against Elvis, Inc., which has a cadre of lawyers, which has basically said, you can't do this. You don't own that image. You haven't sold the license, or we haven't granted you the licensing rights. And it has created a lot of tensions in Elvis culture. I think a lot of fans want to be able to purchase many of the items that are licensed under Elvis Inc., but they also want the freedom that they've always had in Elvis culture to be able to do what they want with Elvis's image.
And is there a difference between the image of Elvis that Elvis Inc. wants to put forward and how the fans perceive him?
I think so. I mean, first of all, there are many, many different kinds of fans. There are, and of course, fans are always trying to one-up themselves and say, well, I'm more of a fan. I'm the true fan. He or she isn't a true fan for all sorts of personal reasons, political reasons. I think there is a difference. I think Elvis Inc.'s idea of image, Elvis's image, is primarily rooted in either the 1956 Elvis as rockabilly star, but not as rebel, or the 1970s Elvis as the Las Vegas showman, but not as an overweight and drug-addicted showman. So it's a very cleaned-up sort of image. Fans are a lot smarter than this. Fans recognize Elvis as a complex individual in American history. They recognize, in other words, the complexities of American history, and they recognize his different sides, his many, many different images. And they don't want to settle for just one or two images that are being offered to them through the corporate sponsor, Elvis, Inc.
And you've mentioned Elvis, Inc. and their relationship to Graceland. I mean, we tend to think of that as being ground zero for Elvis. Is Graceland really the center of the Elvis culture?
I think that it has been. I'm not so sure if it's going to be able to sustain that sort of key role in Elvis culture into the future. It's a very expensive place to visit for a lot of fans. A house tour, I think, now of Graceland is almost $20. But it's the pilgrimage experience of going to Graceland, of going to Memphis, and renting a car, and staying in a hotel, and, of course, spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars at the gift shop. You know, this tends to add up. So for a lot of fans, the shift is from Graceland Central to their own homes or perhaps to their own fan clubs. And what was interesting for me in writing this book, Elvis Culture, was touring a lot of homes, being invited into a lot of homes of fans, and seeing their wonderful Elvis rooms and Elvis shrines and Elvis altars, special places in their homes where they collect their Elvis stuff. And as they said again and again, spend private time, quiet time with Elvis, thinking about Elvis.
And how does this relate to American religious practices in the second half of the century?
I think that we tend to think of American religious practices as being primarily mainstream and institutionalized. And in fact, if you look at the history of American religiosity, it is a mix of both public and private, secular and sacred expressions. Home altars, for example, domestic altars within the American home have existed for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're primarily, of course, the construction of women, long excluded from the sort of public sphere of religion. And to a degree, that's what's going on in a lot of the homes of Elvis fans. Given his reputation as sort of a joke in mass media, it's not surprising that many fans put shrines and altars and sort of special secret places together in their own homes away from public ridicule.
And what does Elvis culture also say about sexual attitudes?
A chapter of the book is about gender and looks extensively at Elvis's many, many impersonators. And what I found interesting was that there are so many different Elvis impersonators and quite a few gay and lesbian Elvis impersonators, which got me to thinking about, you know, what is it about this image of a white heterosexual male that is appealing to both men and women and gays and straights in our culture. And again, I think it's about his essentially mercurial, multifaceted image. Elvis is, in a sense, the premier American icon, sort of this enduring American icon, primarily because of his own ambivalence.
We only have a moment remaining, but what is your own personal favorite expression of Elvis culture?
Well, someone recently read the book and informed me that he wanted to tell me about Elvis's essential role in terms of the Denver Broncos winning of the Super Bowl in recent years. And they had gone to the games here in Denver and had taken big Elvis, velvet Elvis paintings to these playoff games, and had started to chant, "The King will bring a Super Bowl ring." And they believed that their chanting of this Elvis cheer helped John Elway's comeback in football history. So I sort of find that an interesting tale. I'm also particularly fond of Miniature Graceland, which is a miniature construction sort of on dollhouse scale of Graceland in Roanoke, Virginia. If anybody is in the area, they definitely need to check this out.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Erica Doss, professor of fine arts at the University of Colorado Boulder, author of the monograph Elvis Culture, Fans, Faith, and Image.
Continuing our focus on American popular music, jazz may be America's single greatest contribution to world culture, and it's just as popular today as it was decades ago at its origin. Here to examine the recent popularity of jazz in American films is Kryn Gabbard, professor of comparative literature at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Professor Gabbard is also the author of Jammin' at the Margins, Jazz and the American Cinema, published by the University of Chicago Press.
Jazz is back, even in Hollywood. Although no jazz movie has been a hit since 1955, when Jack Webb faked it as a cornetist in Pete Kelly's Blues, no less than 7 jazz films are currently in development, including the new Woody Allen film that opens in a few weeks with Sean Penn as a jazz guitarist. Now, in case you think the trend is nothing but a collection of low-budget flukes, none other than Leonardo DiCaprio has been signed to star in a film about jazz trumpeter and singer Chet Baker, who flourished in the early 1950s. Each of the projected jazz pictures has an engine of its own, and like most films in development, some may never get made. But Hollywood's interest in the lives of jazz artists during and just after World War II surely reflects a new fascination with that era. Think Saving Private Ryan and Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation. Here's what Richard Goldstein has said about the appeal of the culture of the 1940s. For conservatives, it's the old order writ large. For liberals, it's an antidote to postmodern ambiguity. For boomers, it's a tribute to dear old dying dad. And for the emergent young, it's an erotic masquerade. It's those young viewers, of course, who are most important to Hollywood, because they're the ones who buy the most tickets. Perhaps jazz and pop, from before the triumph of rock and roll, can speak to young people today, because the music is sensuous, frivolous, and still accessible. This music has aged extremely well, while the music of the 1960s, with its obsolete codes of rebellion and authenticity, has not. Besides, the kind of jazz that's grabbing the attention of the young isn't that far removed from their aesthetic. The so-called swing revival of the last few years is actually a jump blues revival, bringing back the transitional moment between swing and rock in the 40s and 50s that was captured so compellingly by musicians like Louis Prima, soon to be the subject of a major motion picture starring Brendan Fraser. Ultimately, jazz's significance has as much to do with milieu as it does with music. Even people who don't buy jazz CDs can respond to jazz's associated glamour and transgression. Better still, if the listener has recently become less scrupulous about smoking, cholesterol, and adultery. Jazz, you see, can bring an aura of sophistication to what some might call dissolution. Chet Baker perfectly embodied that transformation in both his music and his persona. So did Stan Getz, who may be played by Christian Slater in a new film. I suppose that the coming wave of jazz films lets us all, young and old alike, have it both ways. In swing, blues, and bop, we can hear our own bittersweet maturation. We can sway to the echoes of both innocence and innocence lost in a deconstructive age when we aren't sure which we cherish more, or if either was real.
You've been listening to Kryn Gabbard, who is the author of Jammin' at the Margins, Jazz and the American Cinema. This is Talking History.
Night and blue, and blue the world.
Welcome back to Talking History. For our site of the week, we return to the king of rock and roll and his palace. And here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Where else would you go to see an Elvis shrine but his own mansion, Graceland? If you've never been there, it's an impressive tour that includes not only a tour of the mansion itself, but the Elvis Auto Museum, which includes his famous 1955 pink Cadillac. There's also Elvis's custom jets at the other end of the plaza and special shows as well. This year, the Elvis birthday celebration runs January 7th through the 9th, and if you can't make that, there is Elvis Week, which takes place each August and has been described by many fans as a huge family reunion when fans of all ages from all over the world get together. This year's celebration is August 10th through the 16th, and if you're worn out after your day at Graceland, you can stay at the new Heartbreak Hotel, which is located at the end of Lonely Street.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, this week calling to your attention two interesting mini-series on the History Channel. The first, an Operation Desert Storm, airs on January 16th. The Air Assault, The Ground Assault, and Desert Victory, as the three segments are titled, all shown on the same night, examine the Allied coalition gathered by President George Bush to fight the 1991 war against Saddam Hussein, the strategies employed, the weapons deployed, and the results. Between January 17th and the 21st, the History Channel will premiere Conspiracy Theory Week. The series will begin on January 17th, examining the various conspiracy theories surrounding the assassination of Robert Kennedy. On January 18th, it will take a look at the Odessa File and the secret Nazi underground that allegedly helped high-ranking Nazi officials escape Germany during the waning days of World War II. And finally, those of you who believe there was a government conspiracy to cover up the supposed UFO crash in Roswell, New Mexico, should tune in Roswell Secrets Unveiled on January 21st. As always, be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we take a look at the history of the bathroom. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
It's now or never. Come hold me tonight. Kiss me, my darling.